right to spend another man's money as he pleases, and I don't care what for."
Balfour was quiet. Until this moment, Lauderback had never once mentioned the fortune that had been discovered in Wells' cottage, or expressed interest in how it was to be deployed. Nor had he once mentioned the legal debacle that revolved around the widow's claim upon her late husband's estate. Balfour had assumed that this silence owed to the fact of Lydia Wells' involvement, for Lauderback was still too embarrassed of his past disgraces to mention her name. But now it seemed almost as though Lauderback had leapt to Crosby Wells' defence. It seemed as though the issue of Crosby Wells' fortune was an issue about which Lauderback cherished a very raw opinion. Balfour glanced at the other man, and then away. Had Lauderback guessed that the fortune discovered in Wells' cottage was the very same fortune by which he had been blackmailed the year before? Balfour's interest was whetted. He decided to provoke the other man.
"What does it really matter?" he said lightly. "Why, most likely that fortune had already been stolen from somebody else. It certainly didn't belong to Crosby Wells. What's a man like him doing with £4,000? It's no secret that he was a wastrel, and the step from a wastrel to a thief is short indeed."
"There's no proof of that," Lauderback began, but Balfour interrupted him.
"Sir, what does it really matter if someone steals it back after he's dead and gone? That's my question. Chances are it was dirty money in the first place."
"What does it matter?" Lauderback exploded. "It's the principle of the thing. It's, as I say, the principle of it. You do not solve a crime by committing another. Thieving from a thief, it's still a crime whichever way you try and dress it. Don't be absurd."
So Lauderback was Crosby Wells' defender, and a very sore defender by the looks of things. This was interesting.
"But you are getting the almshouse you wanted," Balfour said,
still speaking lightly, as though they were discussing something very trivial.
"The money is not to be squandered. It is to be used for the erection of a public works."
"I don't care whether Governor Shepherd is lining his pockets or building an altar,"
Lauderback snapped.
"That's an excuse, that is, using the end to justify the means. I don't deal in that kind of logic."
"And not just any public works," Balfour continued, as if Lauderback had not spoken. "You will get your asylum after all. Come, do you not remember our conversation at the palace? Where's a woman to go? One clean shot at another kind of life, all of that. Well, we are soon to have that one clean shot. George Shepherd has made it so."
Lauderback looked furious. He remembered very well what he had said about the merits of asylum 3 weeks ago, but he did not like his own words to be quoted back to him unless the purpose of the reference was commendation alone.
"It is disrespectful to the dead," he said shortly, "and that is all I will say about it."
But Balfour was not so easily dissuaded.
"I say," he exclaimed, as though the thought had just occurred to him, "the gold that Francis Carver put up against your Godspeed, that had been sewn into the lining of—"
"What about it?"
"Well, you never saw it again, did you? Nor heard tell of it. And then the very same sum, more or less, turns up in Crosby Wells' cottage barely a year later. A little over £4,000. Perhaps it's the very same pile."
"Very possible," said Lauderback.
"One wonders how it got there," said Balfour.
"Indeed one does," said Lauderback.
At the Golden Lion they parted ways, Lauderback having evidently given up on his wish that Balfour remain in Coomara a second day, for he bid his friend good-bye very curtly and without regret. Balfour set off for Hokitika in a state of considerable discomfort. He had promised to keep Nielsen's confidence, as he had on behalf of each one of the men of the Crown, and he had broken that promise. And for what? What had he gained by reneging on his oath and breaking his word? Disgusted with himself, Balfour dug his heels into his mare's flanks, spurring her to a canter. He kept her at that pace until he reached the Arahura River, where he was obliged to dismount, walk the creature down to the beach, and lead her carefully across the shallows at the place where the torrent of fresh water fanned out over the sand. Lauderback had not stayed to watch his friend ride off. He had already begun forming his letter in his mind. His lips were pursed in concentration, and there was a furrow in his brow. He led his horse to the stables, pressed a sixpence into the groom's hand, and then retired at once to his rooms upstairs. Once alone, he locked the door, dragged his writing desk into the diamond-shaped patch of light beneath the window, fetched a chair, sat down, and pulled out a fresh sheet of paper. After some final moments' contemplation with his pen against his lips, he shook out his cuff, leant forward, and wrote, "A posthumous investment? To the editor of the West Coast Times. The 18th of February, 1866. Sir, it is desirable for Mr. George Shepherd to publish in these pages a list of names of persons appointed to the construction of the Hokitika jailhouse upon the terrace at Sea View. Also to transmit a statement of works contracted for and entered into. To reveal the amount of money voted for all such works, the subsidies of sums advanced to date, and the extra amounts required, if any, for their completion, or to render them more serviceable. Such a publication may serve to ameliorate what the undersigned believes to have been a gross breach of conduct on Mr. Shepherd's part, that the preliminary construction of the Hokitika jailhouse was funded by a private donation made without the consent of the Provincial Council, the Westland Public Works Committee, the Municipal Board, or indeed the investor himself, for the investment was made some 2 weeks after the man's own death. I allude here to Mr. Crosby Wells, whose estate has been the subject of much speculation in these pages. It is my understanding that the endowment, such as it might be termed, was extracted from Mr. Wells' dwelling posthumously, and later apportioned without public knowledge to the erection of the future jail. If this understanding is a false one, I shall stand corrected. In the meantime, I request immediate clarification from Mr. Shepherd himself. I hold that the transparency of Mr. Shepherd's conduct in this affair is desirable not least because of the nature of the institution he wishes to build, and the origin of the sum in question, but also for the reason that financial transparency in the management of public funds is of paramount importance, given that this undeveloped region of our province is so rich in gold, and therefore so sadly prey to the primitive temptations of corruption. I maintain a high regard for Mr.